Welcome to Regenerative Medicine Today. This is Leah Kaufman.
And I'm John Murphy. In this podcast, you'll meet Dr. Yoram Vodovitz, an associate professor of surgery and immunology at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine.
Among his many research interests, Dr. Vodovitz studies inflammation. As we'll hear, some inflammation is essential to the healing process, but too much can be deadly. Dr. Vodovitz is using mathematical models and so-called simulated clinical trials to unravel the virtues and vagaries of inflammatory processes.
Let's hear Leah's interview with Dr. Vodovitz now.
We're joined today by Dr. Yoram Vodovitz. He's with the McGowan Institute for Regenerative Medicine, and he runs a center that's part of McGowan that he'll tell us a bit about later. Welcome.
Thank you.
I understand that you had been hoped to be joined today by a collaborator of yours. Do you want to tell us his name and a little bit about him?
Sure. Gilles Clermont, he's an intensivist. He's the medical director for our center, the Center for Inflammation and Regenerative Modeling. He is the person who actually helped this whole enterprise coalesce originally, because as an intensivist and someone who deals with intensive care unit patients all the time, I was highly frustrated by the failure of many therapies. And he sent around calls in an ad hoc fashion to people that might be interested in getting involved in mathematical modeling as a tool that we'll discuss later for making much more accurate predictions of the outcomes with these patients. And he's the first author on what I think is a landmark paper on the use of these mathematical models to carry out simulated clinical trials.
I know we'll talk a lot more about that in a bit. Dr. Vodovitz, tell us about the problem that you're working to solve.
Okay, so what we're addressing is the complex interactions among components of the acute inflammatory response, or sometimes the more chronic inflammatory response, and organ damage or dysfunction, and how that plays out in numerous disease states. We've spent the majority of our time looking at very acute inflammation, very massive processes, which are what occur in the setting of sepsis, which is the setting of infection that has systemic overflow that can lead to basically the stay in the intensive care unit and potentially death, and also the similar types of responses that occur following trauma. For example, accidental trauma, or what happens obviously in the setting of casualty care in the current, you know, war situations, etc.
Okay, so inflammation has a bad rap.
That's right.
But obviously you've already implicated it for our listeners in terms of sepsis. But it seems like usually our body does something because at some level it's good for us. Inflammation probably is one of those things. Can some inflammation be good?
Yeah, so I think the way that people should think of inflammation is that it's an absolutely necessary part of the communication framework that your body has. It's the way that your body tells other parts of itself that there has been some disruption of the normal operating parameters of the body, if you will. We can call that homeostasis. So if you want there to be a strong and solid response, I mean, one analogy I make to people is, you know, if you have a fire at your home and you dial 911, do you want there to be a kind of lackadaisical response, or would you like firefighters to show up at your house really fast? If you're being robbed, do you want to call 911 and have the police show up tomorrow? No, you want it to happen right away, and you want it to be a vigorous response that'll deal with the problem you've got and fix it. So inflammation is that. It's mm-hmm. it's the response of the body to whether it's an invasion from the outside in case of infection, or damage to your own tissues that comes, say, from trauma or from some longer-term process, maybe cancer, maybe some sort of cardiovascular dysfunction, etc. Now, the problem is that to some degree, our current lifestyle and our medical care has actually created certain disease states. So it could be argued that evolution never really meant for us to survive being hit by a truck for 2-3 weeks later. We can do that because we have wonderful new medical technology that can keep us alive past one of these situations, that can allow us to survive. So the problem then is that we've been put into a situation outside of our operating parameters. And now we are doing things that make sense or appear logical to do to these patients in these situations, but that may in fact not be the best and most optimal way to interface with this, all these undergoing processes of inflammation, et cetera, that are going on. So then we that's kind of where this concept of inflammation is bad came along, because you have this event going on, and then you also have this inflammation going on, and you can definitely demonstrate that inflammation, past a certain point, inflammation is making things worse.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if it's at the incipient stages of the septic response, if you make somebody very anti-inflamed, you know, you suppress that person's inflammation, you actually can make the outcome worse, because if there's an infectious agent, for example, that agent can now have an advantage over your body. So the problem that people have is that inflammation is one of these processes, like almost every process in your body, that has a very different manifestations depending on the time period that's elapsed from the time that whatever it was that hit you happened. So whether it was an infection or if it was a trauma or whatever, there are a time-dependent phenomena that occur. Now, we tend to look at discrete time points or associate them with discrete events and say you are now in this phase or that phase, but the reality of it is you are in a continuous changing situation. And as humans, we like to think that we would like to make a single drug or a single therapy that will hit one single mediator or one single process and somehow correct all of it, when the fact is that at any one time or another, you might find yourself in the same process, if you will, on the top of a mountain or at the bottom of a valley, and it's the same process. And mm-hmm. It's very difficult to tell people that you should come up with a logical therapy that somehow fixes both of those problems, but yet they're part of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, even if you look at some of the definitions of how sepsis is defined, you'll find a series of opposites. Not enough white blood cells and too many white blood cells count as part of that definition. High or low blood pressure count as. So basically, it's you know, you can just, when you start thinking about it, you realize that it can't be just a very simple, straightforward, linear sort of definition. So what we're trying to do is to say, look, many biological processes are like these, and people have spent time to develop techniques of simulation and mathematical modeling that can take all these factors, put them together into a model that describes the mechanism that is involved. So understanding some of the biology, of which there's a lot of understanding actually, writing it down in the language of either mathematics or rules that you can put out into computer simulations, where many of these processes will be going on at the same time and interacting with each other, and you can't know in advance what the outcome will be, but if you run these simulations, you can find out what the outcome will be, and you can make very rational decisions about how would you intervene to make this process go towards a beneficial endpoint. So that's basically the gist of the rationale for what it is that we're doing.
I'm trying to imagine the many variables that must be involved in modeling inflammation because of the many variables that are involved in human physiology, for one, but also the many variables that are involved in humankind. Tell me a little bit about your modeling system and how that works.
Right. So as I like to tell people, we have the same basic conceptual framework underlying a series of different models, some that are very simple, that we use to explain the large picture, and some that are very detailed and large, which we actually use for very detailed quantitative predictions. But all of them have, at their core, the following sort of concept. And it's difficult to do this verbally versus graphically, but I think I can try to describe it. So you imagine that you have some sort of an inciting event, an initiating event. That event sets in motion two mutually regulating paths, if you will. One of them is, nominally speaking, a pro-inflammatory path, and one of them is an anti-inflammatory path. The pro and the anti-inflammatory path regulate each other as well. Now, the pro-inflammatory path keeps going to damage, to make tissue damaged so that you can see it under the microscope, you can see cells that are damaged, or dysfunctional, where the cells are, they look okay, they look just like cells that have had nothing wrong with them, except that internally or as a tissue, they don't function correctly. So their end function isn't right. But they're alive, and they're theoretically rescuable, but they're not working correctly. Now, those damaged or dysfunctional cells are producing certain molecules that are now known as alarm or danger signals, which are parts of a cell or proteins in a cell that by day have a normal housekeeping function, but in settings of stress are released and are that first line of alarm that something's gone wrong and that you need to fix it. So the way that works is those alarm danger signals create more inflammation. So there's a positive feedback loop that drives inflammation. So you've had your initiating event, you've made some inflammatory, you've elaborated some inflammatory stimuli, which then cause tissue damage or dysfunction. The tissue damage or dysfunction makes more inflammation. Now you can stay in this loop, and in fact for a while you can make all traces, or you can have all traces of the original initiating stimulus disappear, but yet you're still stuck in now in your own self-fulfilling prophecy or vicious circle. Now the anti-inflammatory arm in the meantime isn't sitting there quietly. Its job is to fix the damage. So many of the same players that are nominally anti-inflammatory are also pro-healing, and that's where we come into this idea of healing and regeneration. Now, so of course, what that's doing is it's having a negative feedback effect. So you can imagine now you have a race between the positive feedback and the negative feedback. You have very crucial dependence on the size and exact nature of the original initiating stimulus, and your own individual genetically set points for the knobs, if you will, the knob settings. For inflammation, anti-inflammatory inflammation, the damage response. So you could imagine that you can get many, many outcomes of these simulations, and in fact we do. So, and that's in fact how we create simulated clinical trials, which is one of the translational uses of the kind of work that we do. And that's something that I'd be happy to discuss more in a bit. But the whole concept that we're trying to put forward here is, while we've spent a lot of time creating models that can be of interest to people who are theoreticians, the real goal of our work and the one that we've spent a lot of time on is to say, okay, we create models in such a way so that they will be as immediately useful in a clinically translational fashion as possible.
Okay.
We're trying to use this terminology of translational systems biology, which to differ from the more, if you will, mainstream, if such a word can be used, systems biology that people can the people who know the field can think of these days, where there might be incredibly detailed studies of simpler organisms or extensive genomic, proteomic, etc. analysis of certain processes. We're focused on the mediators that are known to operate, and we're focused on creating the models in such a way so that the outcome of the models is as useful either for a clinical or preclinical setting as possible.
So I imagine if you have a model that's useful clinically, that model is helping you to determine elements or markers of certain stages of inflammation or mediation. Because as you said, we take a lab test and we're looking at a snapshot at a single point in time, but that single point in time is giving us a different snapshot depending on all of those variables that you just described.
That's right.
But if we had a physiological marker or two that indicated that, okay, regardless of time point, regardless of end time, you know, this is happening, so now we give medication X to mediate this process that we can see is happening. Is that the sort of thing when you say clinically translatable?
You have to be very careful in the sense that, we published a paper a couple of years ago where we introduced this simulated clinical trial methodology and even talked about how you might get some early, quote, biomarkers of the way that the response was evolving. The problem is that the markers themselves are useless without the model because they might be higher than or lower than a healthy point at any one time or another. So, mm-hmm. So for example, the disease versus the sickness, or the disease plus effective drug versus disease plus placebo, in those settings, a particular biomarker relative to each other may be higher, lower, et cetera. They may be flip-flopping over time.
Mm-hmm.
And so to say that, oh, okay, with the modeling, we then can reduce it down to one or two or 20 things that you can measure all the time and know just from the measurements where you are, no. But if you measure those things and you have a framework to hang them on, which is what the model is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, imagine you have a cloth and you're trying to make a dress or a suit. You either have to have a human body to hang it on or one of those nice mannequins to hang it on. Otherwise, it's a cloth, and your best guess at how to make a suit. The concept of a framework is to take the data and put them on a path where it makes sense. And now, look at that. I have a form, something I can see that tells me, yeah, I understand what this shape is. I can, if you continue that analogy, you take that cloth, you hang it on that mannequin, you start to figure out, okay, that looks like a suit. You can pretty much know where the sleeve is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
If you just looked at the cloth lying there, the sleeve could be anywhere.
And it's widely open to interpretation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
I
so the thing that differentiates what we do from the either statistical models, which try to get a lot of data as a trade-off for not having really any knowledge about the process, is that we don't need as much data because we like to put in the knowledge a priori. Now, putting the knowledge in is difficult and time-consuming and a process that takes a lot of time to do.
Mm-hmm.
But once you've achieved that, and we have to some degree, you can be in the situation where getting some simple, easily obtained measurements, hanging them on the framework of our model, importantly because our model contains this idea of damage or dysfunction and how it iterates with inflammation, we can use that damage variable as, first of all, as an index of how well you're doing health-wise. And B, it's not just an independent variable there, it's connected to the rest of the model. That's something that nobody else has done before.
I see.
There is now sufficient evidence, even at the molecular level, that says that these kinds of responses are tied in through this damage or danger signals, so that the responses to pathogens and the responses to your own damaged tissues are even occurring via the same receptors, via the same cell types, etc. So our models have had that idea in them for 5-6 years.
Mm-hmm.
The literature is in a way catching up to that now in terms of showing that in fact it happens, that the danger response is involved in wound healing, or that inflammatory derangements are important in wound healing, etc. Our models would predict all of that.
I see. So tell me what you envision as a good practical application of your work to, you know, a real-life sepsis situation.
Right. So we have, because we felt that we had to put our money or our effort where our mouth is, several years ago, we helped start a company here in Pittsburgh, Immunetrics Incorporated. So by way of disclosure, I'm one of the co-founders of that. The concept behind that was that we could use these mathematical models to generate simulated clinical trials, and that we could then mine the data that comes out of that in order to be able to predict whether a particular drug could or could not work well. To predict, for example, which patients should be included or excluded from receiving the drug, even to the point of saying what ages should they be, and if so, what hospitals should the trial be done in, because you can micro-dissect this down to that level in these simulations. And we're now incorporating additional comorbidities. But things like the genetics of an individual have been wired into these simulations for a long time. That's a very important translational application. Each clinical trial might cost $50 to $100 million. If you can rule out at a very early stage of the game whether you should or should not proceed with a particular compound, even if it was later enough in the game, even if it's after phase one, you can still make quite an impact with a model. You might make impact even after phase two, and as we're finding, the company has been interacting with some pharmaceutical companies, you can even intervene after phase three when there's a desire to go to phase four and expand the indication or change it or whatever. So that's one application. Another application is to use these models for rational drug design. So you could do the same kinds of ideas with the simulated trials, except ahead of that, you could be running simulations about what should the characteristics of the drug be in order to have an impact at the end. So that's a very important application. Another one that's, again, all along the same path is reduction of animal usage, because animals are used in research and in the preclinical phases of drug development. Well, if you know relatively little about how a drug works and you're doing these experiments in animals, first of all, the experiments themselves are... the animal models are not as true representatives of the human disease as one would like, often. And moreover, you don't have any particularly rational idea about how to use this drug, so you have to try a lot of different combinations. So a lot of animals get experimented on in that process. Well, with these kind of simulations, you can greatly reduce the number of animals because you can pinpoint the drug of interest and roughly the timing of interest, etc., because we've calibrated some of our models to specific aspects of inflammation that occur in, say, mice versus rats versus larger animals, et cetera. And we have a model in humans. So you can make inferences at every stage of the way as to what will happen in people.
How do the regulatory bodies feel about doing these sort of virtual trials? Are they as accepting of the data as they have been of good old-fashioned trials?
Right, so that's actually that's very much at the cutting edge. The FDA has put out a document that is abbreviated as the Critical Path document. It's got a very long name that actually says that companies should be exploring and making use of these computer models as a way of streamlining the drug development process, number one, and number two, reducing the number of failed trials. So in fact, the FDA has called for this to be done. The reality of it is that certainly for an inflammation field, but for in most other fields, no one has come to the table with this kind of technology. So we have not yet sat down with the FDA for this, but I could envision a situation down the road where it'll almost become mandatory to do this kind of simulation before you even go into your animal work.
Mm-hmm.
Because
Building an efficiency very early on,
right
upstream.
Exactly. And in fact, you could argue on ethical reasons even that that a drug shouldn't even make it to phase one if it hasn't been passed through these kind of simulations to verify that it even ever has a chance of working in people.
Maybe I'm just reflecting my own Luddite tendencies, or maybe I'm having difficulty with the paradigm shift of this notion. But, you know, I worry about a lot of downstream, results that are now being applied to a human population that may be based on some error or some variable that, you know, should or should not have been included way much earlier upstream in the process. Are there checks and balances for things like that?
Yeah, so the strategy that we've outlined within this concept of the rational drug design, but you can think of it as rational therapy development or whatever, would be if you have a reasonable model of the disease where you've run simulated trials that look like trials that have been published. So we've done that and are doing that. And first of all, you can run many more simulated cases than you can real cases. So we can run, say, to 10 to the 7th simulations. You know, you can run more simulations than there are people on Earth if you want.
So your results have more statistical,
in some sense, right?
Significance.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's the first part. But the second part is you say, okay, if my drug is to be efficacious there and you test it out, then you can make very specific predictions about what that drug should do, say, in mice.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just that you're trying it in mice and going, well, it looks favorable, so let's move it to the next stage. You say, no, if it was to have worked in humans the way I say it should, then it should do very precise, quantitatively predicted things in mice. Then you actually test it in mice, and you determine just how close you are. That gives you some confidence right from the beginning as to whether you're in the right ballpark or not. So let's assume that you get close, but not exactly the same. Then you might say, well, okay, is that close? Is that good? What if we proceeded? Would it be harmful to people later? Well, you can then take those properties that you actually find that are close to but not the same, say, as the ones that you actually predicted, and you wire them back into the original simulation and say, if the drug had these other slightly different properties, would it still have a chance of doing something favorable in people? And let's just say it still says it does. You say, okay, great. Well, what would you predict then that would happen in rats or in some other experimental species that's larger on the chain as you move towards humans? And you can keep doing this iterative step. And with each step, you can gain tremendous amount of confidence in the benefit or the potential benefit of this drug. And at the final stage of it, you can say, okay, well, if I had 20 patients that have very specific characteristics and this drug has now been as passed every other step of the way, okay, which up until now it does, but only based on the FDA guidelines, which don't involve this level of precision. You say, okay, if I had, say, 20 patients and this was their characteristics that they have, well, my drug should do this quantitative effect, and you predict that, and you get very close to that, then I think you have the the most possible rational basis to move forward to a full, in a full phase two, let's say, or phase three trial.
Mm-hmm.
Often, where a lot of the failures of, the, of these drugs have occurred is that they everything has been managed reasonably well, and they make it through the animal studies. They make it through the phase one. They even make it past phase two, and then they die at phase three. Mm-hmm. I mean, our simulations could be done to tailor it for a phase two or a phase three trial, and so you could have an idea that you may find that it would say, yeah, you know, our simulations would say that it'll do great through phase two and die as soon as you go to the kind of expected population that you're going to find in phase three. Mm-hmm. And so either you have to find some way to change the phase three, or you have to know that right from the beginning. And so have you not then done a tremendous amount of benefit? I mean, imagine that you have got, you have managed to take out as much of the risk as possible, mm-hmm. all the way up the chain. I mean, people don't always realize, but any device that you use right now that has an, the potential to impact human life, say an airplane or a car or a building, has been simulated before you ever made a prototype, and certainly before you ever put people in it. But medicine is done pretty much by the scientific method and then application onto people. There are a few places where simulation does occur. For example, radiation treatment planning for cancer, that's done in simulation because you're, again, working with a large amount of energy that you're delivering to a tissue, and so they're doing patient-specific simulation, and they run through it to be sure their equipment is working right. Only then do they actually do a patient.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few other settings as well where you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
But why wouldn't it make sense that something like that should be the preferred way of doing it in the medical setting, if it,
does, it
was available?
Yeah, it does make sense, actually. The way when you put it that way, it's, you know, we're simulating, rather than simulating the building before we put the people in it, we're simulating the medicine before we put it in the people.
That's right. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
And of course, as these models get used more, the whole methodology we've outlined is one that is designed to break the models.
Mm-hmm.
So we've designed an iterative methodology of researching the original, researching the data in the literature to find out what are the basic mechanisms, converting that into models or of some sort or another, collecting data to calibrate the models so that they are quantitatively faithful to the process, but then making predictions using the models in order to find out just are the models just good at being fit to the data, or are they good at actually predicting something? And typically that means predicting something on which the models were not trained.
Mm-hmm.
So statistics are used in the same way, except that they're typically picked, they're validated by saying, okay, here's my large data set. I take a part of it, I leave aside, I use that for calibration of my model. I take the other part and I say, could that first part have been used to give me some prediction of what happened in my second part? I'm saying, imagine that you have a completely different data set of completely different but related disease process, and could you have used the first one to make a prediction for the
mm-hmm.
second one? That's effectively the Holy Grail. That's what everybody wants, is to take the smallest amount of existing data and make a prediction for what will happen next in another slightly different setting.
Mm-hmm.
That's effectively what one could call a phase four application of a drug. Is phase three got you to some approval. Phase four is, well, that plus a bit more. And that's, statistical models really are not theoretically even capable of doing that. And yet they're being used in that fashion all the time. So it's not surprising then that we find ourselves with settings where drugs all of a sudden have these massive adverse effects. That's because they're taken typically just a bit outside their original context. The kinds of simulations we're talking about allow you to bridge that gap.
I see. I'm curious to know how sort of open source the raw data sets are, because it must take an enormous amount of effort, as you said so yourself, to collect all of that data. And you're talking about multiple data points. You know, for each data instance, you know, there's many, many elements, you know, that make up that entire set. And I know that in public health, there's sharing of data sets occasionally so that different researchers can do sort of what you were describing, glean the answers to different questions based off the same data set. So what's the story with your industry?
Right. So actually that question does come up at times. All of our models that have been published, including the small ones and the ones that are larger that have data associated with them, are published in the literature. The
mm-hmm.
models are there in the papers for people to see. We also have them as downloads from our website. And so people can get to them anytime. In my group, in the center, we've established a database that has these data. They are theoretically there to be distributed. Of course, we have to check who it is that's asking. Mm-hmm. And especially as we move into having human data, there's substantially increased complications with HIPAA and other regulatory aspects.
It has to be de-identified.
Exactly. And that, yeah. Exactly. And certainly our animal data are open for people to interact. Now, Immunetrics has augmented the models and created some proprietary versions of them, but people can obviously interact with them directly in whatever fashion sort of makes sense for them.
Okay. Now, you mentioned your center. Tell our listeners the name of the center.
Right. So it's the Center for Inflammation and Regenerative Modeling.
And let's hone in on that regenerative part a bit, since we're here to talk about regenerative medicine. What's the application of what you're doing to helping healing?
So we've recently taken this idea, if you recall how I described how we visualize the inflammatory process, where, again, it's not inflammation in isolation, but it's inflammation as a driving force towards healing. Okay. And we've looked at a couple of different settings where healing is deranged. One interesting one, and one which the University of Pittsburgh and UPMC certainly interact with a lot, is diabetic foot ulcers. So people that have diabetes have circulatory problems and also sensory deficiencies, and so they often get wounds at the bottom of their feet that remain unhealed or are chronically made worse.
Mm-hmm.
Our limb preservation wound healing clinic here, which is run by David Steed, is the largest clinic in the country dealing with these ulcers. Now, what we did is we used our basic concept of inflammation to wound healing and focused more on the healing part. So we were able to calibrate our models to the kind of data that one gets in the literature about the way skin healing occurs, where there is an inflammatory phase which we can reproduce, leading to a healing phase. And we tested some hypotheses about derangements that have been written in the literature to characterize or to be associated with diabetic foot ulcers. And literally plugging in a single change, one of a couple of different changes that have been hypothesized to accompany diabetic foot ulcer healing, we were able to get simulations of delayed healing and increased inflammation. We then simulated some therapies that are known to be effective, or at least partially effective, and were able to show how, in our simulations, they would in fact be effective, including even simulating the surgical debridement of a wound to some degree.
Just to interrupt, is that a test of your model?
Validation is always a test.
Okay.
I mean, each time, I think theoretically you can never stop testing the model.
Mm-hmm.
And again, because a model will never be the exact one-to-one replication of reality, you can
mm-hmm.
imagine, if you just think about it philosophically, it's just not possible. The best you can do is just greatly increase the level of refinement of
mm-hmm.
prediction before you break the model. The goal is to get to a point where the model is in pretty good shape to make useful predictions, and in our point of view, useful means in some translational clinical fashion.
Okay.
And so to restate that which I said before, that's our ultimate goal. That's what drives all of this work. So I think at least the model in the setting of sepsis and trauma that I mentioned is in a pretty good state for that. This new model, I think, is also in a pretty good state where we can even make predictions about some novel compounds or the properties of novel compounds. So that's one application of that. We used the same basic backbone of the model, but calibrated a bit differently for a very interesting project with Kitty Vertolini here in our School of Health and Rehabilitation Science. And they look at healing in a context I'm sure you'll be familiar with, which is vocal folds. So vocal fold inflammation occurs with people that talk a lot, like me, and I guess you, and teachers. And teachers, I think, are the major sufferers from this, but I think also people that work in loud environments, construction workers, etc. I'm sure everybody's experienced this kind of feeling of hoarseness and inflammation that doesn't really come from a cold or from something, but just from overuse. And Kitty's group has done very tough to do work in using actual human data that they get from human volunteers or patients, where they can measure inflammatory mediators right there in the vocal folds. And they find that the same mediators that one would find in a tissue trauma of any sort are being elaborated mm-hmm. there. Now, they've taken it further, and their concept of regenerative medicine is to say, just as you might imagine happens in other types of rehabilitation, maybe rest isn't the best thing to do. Maybe the best thing to do is to have some sort of exercise for the vocal folds as a way of getting them to heal themselves. And in fact, our models predict that that should happen. Mm-hmm. So if you have this, if you can conceive of the original phonotrauma as being a big initiating event that sets in motion the pro and the anti-inflammatory events, well, you can play with smaller secondary traumas, which would be this exercise.